Now, last time we looked a little really at the story of Taliesin, because connected with, so the four branches are this interconnect of the Mabinogi, this interconnected set of stories really, that form their own mandala, their own kind of shaping. Which now the story of Taliesin gives us the sense of what is it to be a bard. And if we remember that story, we are given this kind of image, really, of this profoundly archetypal place, the Lake of Lakes, Penachlin, the thing that is the head or the origin of the lake. And we have this kind of, if you like, almost Adam and Eve, really, where you've got Ceridwen, we've got this archetypal family, we've got Ceridwen and Teged the Bald, we've got Avagdi and Croiri, the son and the daughter, and we have this sense of Ceridwen, who has this great enchantress. And who has given birth to the most beautiful girl in the world and the most ugly son in the world. So you can see again the interplay of the opposites here, and this sense of this great operation that Ceridwen undertakes. It's interesting this story, because it isn't to make Avagdi beautiful, because the sense of ugliness, the sense of shadow, the sense of things that are flawed and incomplete are essential to the universe. So we're not trying to, she's not getting a potion that will transform Avagdi into being a beautiful boy, but to give him the gifts of a poet, because his inner beauty will mean that people will love him because of the inner beauty that is made manifest, no matter how flawed he is in outward appearance.
But flawedness is essential for change, isn't it?
Yes, no, totally, completely. So it's that asymmetry, right? It's that kind of, so perfect, a balanced, totally balanced form that just balances, loses, doesn't have dynamism. So in a certain sense, if we had, to use the imagery of that particular story, if you had the beautiful boy, the beautiful girl, the beautiful parents, it's static. There is no need for movement.
There's almost no need for life to manifest, and that,
yeah,
is the,
that's right.
It would end up back at,
yeah.
Yeah, back to go back to God, wouldn't you? And it would be,
yeah. That's right. So there's something about, both, in the Christian myth, you have the kind of, the Adam and Eve disobeying God, and that creates a whole kind of thing. Here you have a similar thing, that there's something flawed that means that Ceridwen has to find a way to put this right. And what Ceridwen has to do, particularly if we think of this, looking at the Awen and working with the dynamics of the Awen and the Tau, she has to make a journey, first of all, to the Ferichta, the alchemists that are found deep in the heart of the earth, deep in the heart of the universe. And this, in a way, is a coded way of talking about the great field of the stars. The story begins really with the pilgrimage of Ceridwen, where she makes her prayer to the Ferichta, and is shown that what she has to do is to make a, to set up a cauldron and place within the cauldron all the outward forms of everything that has become manifest. So what she has to do, in effect, is become a creatrix, because she, because in a certain sense, she is the cauldron. She is the, it's from her womb that that everything comes. And so in order for the person who drinks of this potion, which is the essence of the Awen, in order for this to be to really work, everything has to return and be distilled down into its essence. And its essence is this triangular dynamic. That has the singularity and the opposites within it. So that the person who drinks of that becomes a bard and is able then to work with the dynamic of the opposites. And they're interesting, the figures who help her in this. So Tegid is this background kind of figure. We'll come to Tegid in just a second. Because Tegid is a guardian figure. Tegid is on the outside, kind of, but also he's a figure that holds the energies of destruction as well. So the people that help the Redwen in this is we have Little Gwion. He's always called Little Gwion. Whose job it is to keep the cauldron stirring and moving, so enables things to keep mixing themselves, enables that sense of constant reflection and counter-reflection to keep on happening. But the other figure that there is Blind Morvthar, who we don't know much about, who is like a titanic kind of figure, who keeps bringing wood to the fire, who feeds the flame. And he's like a sort of ancient, archaic giant somewhere, whose job it is to keep the cauldron bubbling, to keep the fire, the alchemical fire, alive. And so what we see, his name Morvthar, M-O-R-D-A.
I'm sure I remember reading somewhere that when, in her rage, she knocks out his eye, knocks out Morda's eye. I don't know if it's in all the versions, but like that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means. It's just, you don't much hear about him other than that he gets his eye knocked out. And you don't often hear that, but it's an interesting sort of aspect.
It is an interesting thing, really, about how that Morda's eye is blinded because or has only one eye. You know, it's sort of he's a kind of interesting. Again, he's one of these shadowy figures. He's first of all, he's just told, you know, he's really the kind of he's brought up is a very complex kind of figure somewhere. Because the sense where he is blind Morda can mean because the eye that she's beating out when he's blind before she knocks his eye out. Mm. Right, so these are these kind of mysterious things and it's playing with time. That you find in this strange bit of the story, because why would you beat out the eye of a blind man? Did he become blind because Gwion was going to have the potion? So here you see time being played with strangely, and it's a bit like we're in the heart of a black hole somewhere, or really on the edge.
Totally. There's something about Gwion that's like, you know, he's like a quantum. He's like the smallest. In the same way that Flay becomes, you know, it comes from that little tiny thing that Gwion gathers up. The smallest thing, like, there's always this small thing. And I don't know if that's the thing that goes through a lot of Celtic mythology. I don't know enough about Celtic mythology yet, but it seems to be this, the profundity of this little Gwion, this tiny little packet.
Yeah, he's like the quantum he's like the quantum fluctuation, right? So it's like that quantum sort of collapse into wave particle kind of fluctuation that perturbs everything around it, and so in this place you find these strange things happening. So you find kind of, you know, Mordor, who's this blind archaic figure who loses his eye because Gwion gets his, gets the portion and not Abagdi. And yet, of course, he's blind already. And why is she doing that? So what's being hinted at here is time is strange here. We're in this beginning place where things are not as they seem. We've got this strange background figure. We have this energy of creation. And yet we have Tegid sitting there, who's called Tegid the Bald, and the one of the very few other places we hear about Tegid is in one of the triads, where we're talked about the three things that cause the destruction of Logres, are the freeing of prisoners, the receiving of strangers, and the gift of the bald man. Now, it's a particularly, this is a particularly kind of gnomic triad, because the freeing of the prisoner is one of the great traditions of Welsh mythology. It's the freeing of Mabon, who is imprisoned. It's the freeing of Pryderi from prison. It's the release of all of us from prison into new life. And so there, and the freeing of prisoners causes the destruction of Logres. The receiving of strangers is one of the great, sacred duties of any Welshman or of any Celt. It's to be the host, and yet the receiving of strangers is the, and this is echoes into the second branch and how that happens. That causes destruction. And then we have this completely thing we don't find anywhere else, the gift of the bald man. Now, what is the gift of the bald man here somewhere? Now, he is the bald man, Tegid the Bald, is the father of Kukwuri and Abagdi. He's the husband of so is Abagdi the gift of the bald man? Is Kururi the gift of the bald man? What is the destruction that happens? Because actually what happens is, as the one of the things that happens is that when the cauldron is complete and the drops are received by Gwion, the cauldron explodes and then becomes this destructive, poisonous thing. So we're with destruction, creation, we're with the singularity point, we're with the white holes and black holes, so we're really in that kind of energy of creation. It really is the activity of the Awen that's wrapped around by the stillness of the Tao. And what we find happening really, and so what happens really when this whole year and a day process, so what happens is this process of gathering all the essences of things, which brings them into the cauldron, in a certain sense brings them back into the womb of Ceridwen, who in a certain sense is the great mother who manifests everything, and it's that image and which medieval bards would have seen also as Mary, the mother of Christ. You get these images of her with Christ sitting in her belly. Because what happens if we look at this process, Gavagdi gets robbed, Gwion receives the essence of the Awen, and then acquires thereby the ability, rather like Menno, son of Tyrwedd, the ability to take all shapes. And then we get this sort of the Ceridwen, whose name means simultaneously the crooked woman, but the beloved woman, then becomes the rageful woman, the destroying goddess. You see the face, the sow who devours her young. And that's when you see this great unfolding, as the son, as the mother and the son go through this great chase through the universe, which starts off in, you know, starts off in Earth, by him becoming a hare and she becoming a dog, a greyhound bitch. Him plunging into water and she becoming as a salmon and she becoming a she otter. Him flying up into the air. So these three qualities that we have of Ninvre, Golaur and Kalkalas are implicit in that poem, and they're the realms of earth and sea and air. And so in a sense, he's being chased through the whole of the universe, transforming. And then we get this very powerful place then where he drops down into becoming a single grain in a heap of grain. And she becomes this great black hen who systematically devours each and every grain, including the grain that is Taliesin, but then is impregnated by Taliesin. So we get this turning about. The destroyer then becomes the creatrix again. And we get this place of her sitting with him. And this is, you know, in a certain sense, you could say this is the goddess who is also the hen, who gives birth to the child, who is also the egg, who then we get this tussle then. Is she going to kill him? Is she not? And so that rage that's in her is abated because of his beauty. And then she cuts him loose. So this is cutting energy of the goddess. And he's then taken off into the great sea in the skin bag, in the coracle. And there he is taught by the great totems, the great ancient beings. So we're back somewhere there in the red lady, the red man of Paviland, where he's in that deep place, the deep sea, the deep time, the deep kind of listening, having to kind of integrate really the energies of the universe through his Tao, listening to that working of the universe. Until he comes to land. And so when he comes to land, he then intersects into history. And then we get this jump in the story where we come to the story of Elfin. And Elfin is this, you know, who is called Elfin the Unlucky. And it's worth reading this bit of it actually. So of course, what the Mabinogi tells us is Elfin, son of Gwyndor of Gahanir, who is the most hapless of youths and the most needy. And so we got this parallel again with Abagdi, who is a kind of, you know, the poor person. And it grieved his father sore, for he thought he was born in an evil hour. And by the advice of his council, his father had granted him the drawing of the weir that year, which is the great salmon draught that comes into the shores of Dyfi, so that good luck would ever befall him and give him something to begin himself in the world. And the next day, when Elfin went to look, there was nothing in the weir. But when he turned back, he noticed a leather bag on a pole of the weir. Then one of the weir wards, one of the people guarding the weir, said to Elfin, You were never so unlucky until tonight, and now you have destroyed the virtues of the weir. So it's not only are you unlucky in yourself, you're destroying the luck of the land. This weir always yielded the value of £100 every May Eve, and to nothing. And tonight there is nothing but this leathern skin within it. And Elphin, who is nothing but optimistic, says, "Well, how now? There may be the value of £100 in it." Well, they took up the leathern bag, and he opened it, saw the forehead of the boy, and said to Elphin, "Behold the radiant brow," which in Welsh is Taliesin. "Taliesin be he called," said Elphin, and as he lifted the boy in his arms, lamenting his mischance, he placed him sorrowfully behind him, and he made his horse ample gently, that had before been trotting, and he carried him as softly as if he had been sitting in the easiest chair in the world. And presently the boy made a consolation and praise to Elphin, and foretold honour to Elphin. And the consolation of this, fair Elphin ceased to lament. Let no one be dissatisfied with its own. To despair will bring no advantage. No man sees what supports him. The prayer of Cunchlo will not be in vain. God will not violate his promise. Never in Gwyndo's Mere was there such good luck as this night. Fair Elphin, dry your cheeks. Being too sad will not avail. Although you think you have no gain, too much grief will bring you no good. Do not doubt the miracles of the Almighty. Though I am but little, I am highly gifted. From seas and mountains and from the depths of rivers, God brings wealth to the fortunate man. Elphin of lively qualities, thy resolution is unmanly. You must not be over sorrowful. Trust in God and to forebode ill. Weak and small as I am, on the foaming beach of the ocean, in the day of trouble I shall be of more service to thee than 300 salmon. Elphin of notable qualities, be not displeased at thy misfortune, but though reclined thus weak in my bag, there lies a virtue in my tongue. While I continue thy protector, you have not much to fear. Remembering the names of the Trinity, none shall be able to harm you." So this sense of you have caught this little being, but this little being who is the Awen incarnate, who remembers the names of the Trinity, who holds that triadic principle of the Awen within him, and is able therefore to bring about the energy of creation because of that. And he goes on, he's taken before the king, and Gwyndo Gahan Garhanhir asks him, "Well, who are you? Are you a spirit? Are you a man?" And Taliesin said, "First, I have been formed a comely person. In the court of Ceridwen I have done penance. Though little, I was seen, placidly received. I was great on the floor of the place to where I was led. I have been a prized defence, the sweet muse is the cause. And by law without speech I have been liberated by a smiling black old hag. When irritated, dreadful her claim when pursued." So he's giving a little version of his beginning points. "I was great on the floor of the place to where I was led. I have been a prize defence, the sweet muse is the gore." So somewhere Ceridwen is both the smiling or black old hag, and it is also the muse here. "Dreadful her claim when pursued. I have fled." So then we have the pursuit. I have fled with vigour, I have fled as a frog. I have fled in the semblance of a crow, scarcely finding rest. I have fled vehemently, I have fled as a chain. I have fled as a roe into an entangled thicket. I have fled as a wolf cub. I have fled as a wolf in the wilderness. I have fled as a thrush of pretending language. I have fled as a fox used to the concurrent bones of quirks. I have fled as a martin which did not avail. I have fled as a squirrel that vainly hides. I have fled as a stag's antler of ruddy course. I have fled as iron in glowing fire. I have fled as spearhead of woe to such that has a wish for it. I have fled as a fierce bull fiercely bitterly fighting. I have fled as a bristly boar seen in a ravine. I have fled as a white grain of pure wheat on the skirt of a hempen sheet entangled that seemed the size of a mare's foal that is filling like a ship into the waters. Into a dark leathern bag I was thrown, and on a boundless sea I was sent adrift, which was to be an omen of being tenderly nursed, and then the Lord God set me at liberty. So you find him telling you all these things, and you hear the interplay, really, of Ceridwen and Taliesin within this, and sort of the, and how that kind of movement between, this creative movement, transforming from one thing to another thing to another thing. And then this thing that right at the end, as the white grain of pure wheat, coming to the essence point, the anion point of the bard, falling into the skirt of a hempen sheet, getting entangled, that seemed as big as the size of a mare's foal, that is filling like a ship on the waters. And this is where he's really talking about this kind of, the sense of what happens then is in this last place where he's part of the, he's taken up and then into the mystery of the womb of Ceridwen. And then he is cast out again into the boundless sea, which was to me an omen of being tenderly nursed. So,
what is it about fleeing, Ian? This thing, because it's quite,
well, it's a dynamic, Rob. It's a dynamic. It's, this is a dynamic between she and he.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you think of a game of cat chasing. It's like a sort of chasing, hiding. It's like a hide and seek that enables all the things of the universe to come into being.
So he's continually sort of found out or something? Or
continually found, continually has to flee into different shapes. So this is this thing of the one thing becoming the thousand things, one becoming many. As she kind of pursues him and has her energy. So this kind of energy of, and in a certain sense, it's one of these complicated things of creation coming out of destruction.
So we wouldn't change if we weren't afraid and running from something or pursued by something, would we? We have to change, but due to inadversity, don't we?
Well, adversity helps us to change in some ways. But it's got something of that kind of, it's got something of that kind of quality. But at the human level, but at that deep archetypal level, you've got that kind of, if you like, that sort of energy of destruction that actually enables creation. You know, the kind of, you know, if you think of the energy of the stars, the energy of a sun, what happens in the great fusion reaction that is the sun that liberates light? Eventually the sun becomes inert as a result of that and collapses into itself, becoming finally, eventually a black hole. So that indivisibility of creation and destruction, and that sense of, you know, light creates substance, but light unshielded, light that comes too strongly into us destroys us. So what the bards are looking at here is this kind of mystery of creation and destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And we have right at the heart of this story, this kind of, because this whole thing comes about, the whole motivating energy of this is Ceridwen's love for Avagddi and desire to heal Avagddi, not heal him exactly, but to give him a quality that will mean he will be loved despite his ugliness. And so we get this whole process of her hatred and her rage, the Rachel clarity energy that keeps on creating differentiation. But then it curves back on itself when he somehow returns to her and becomes part of her, becomes her child, becomes beautiful. And then her capacity to love means that she cannot kill him, but also she holds also her hatred for him, So she's holding the opposites. So out of that, then the third thing happens, which is the movement out of the archetypal place into the movement of time and space through the transitional place, which is like the art on the Tree of Life, which is the Great Sea, where there is a whole kind of, if you like, him being nurtured and looked after by the sea and by the great beings, totems that are part of him, until he comes into time and space, really, at the weir of Gwyndo Gahan here, who is known as Gwyndo the Generous, who possesses the hamper of perfect total fertility. So he is this kind of, so Gwyndo is a kind of grail keeper, really, who possesses the capacity to make everything fertile. But his son is the opposite of Gwyndo. So all the time they're playing with opposites. So Gwyndo is the lucky king, the king who is the fertility. Now in Celtic tradition, kings, the fertility of the land is deeply linked to the sovereignty of the king. So if the land is not fertile, if things don't work, then the king loses his sovereignty. And so we have this difficult situation for Gwyndo, who has this hapless, unlucky son. Which is why they, in sort of desperation, he's going, okay, let him be the person who guards the weir. That never fails. Surely he will then start to acquire the luck of a true king. And of course, he gets no fish at all. But what he gets, in a sense, is the great fish. Is the another place we find Taliesin saying, "It is not known with my flesh is whether I am flesh or fish." Because he is the great salmon. And the salmon in Welsh tradition is the oldest of all beings, who knows all the stories, who comes from the great lake, the place of the beginnings. So all the time in this story, which is the point of the whole story of Taliesin, and why this would be contemplated, is you're looking at what is it to be about? What are the dynamics? And the very central thing about being about is this ability to work with the Awen and the Tau, and to work with the great song of the universe, so as to generate life, to liberate people. Because what the story goes on to do, really, is then we find, we enter the, if you like, the world really of Elfin, and the world of the Overlord King, who is Maeglin Gwynedd, who is a famous tyrant and sort of a bard king, we would say, you know, and so we have Taliesin, who is this great treasure, this great inheritance, in a sense, of who's come from somewhere else, who's blessing the court of Elfin. Now Elfin goes off to the court of Maegle and Gwynedd, and in the place of a great tyrant, boasts about how beautiful and virtuous his wife is. It's a bit like she's the best woman in all the land. It'll be a bit like being at a press conference with Trump and claiming that your partner is more beautiful and more wise than Melania. You know it's not going to go well if you do that. Right, so of course poor old Elfin is thrown into prison, and the way these stories are so interesting, because they contain almost all these, they contain so many elements that cross over between the different stories. Because one of the key things you find in Welsh tradition is this opposite of imprisonment and liberation. And this sense of foolishness and rashness, having to be kind of people having to be rescued from these unconscious, unwitting things they do and say. And you can see the haplessness of Elphin. Just like in the first branch, you see the folly of Pwyll, who won't listen to Rhiannon. And so here what happens is, of course, Taliesin goes to the court of Maeglin and Gwynedd, and is again this small being, but who possesses the Arwen, possesses all the gifts of the Arwen, but also possesses his gift of silence, so he can just sit in the corner of the room. And the... I'm missing a piece out. So before we come to that, we have then the Maeglin Gwynedd decides that he was going to prove to Elphin that his wife is not virtuous, because he sends his beautiful and seductive son to the court of Elphin to seduce Elphin's wife. But because Taliesin is connected to everything through his sense of the Arwen, he concocts this scheme where one of the servant girls takes the place of her mistress, exchanges places with her mistress. So there's a whole, you know, this isn't about social things or anything like that. This is about this principle of exchange and one thing being exchanged for another. So there's a playing of appearance and anian and firm. So this is being kind of played with here somewhere. So that Rin in turns out to be somebody who is fooled by the appearance of Elphin's wife, who is not Elphin's wife. And so when Maeglin Gwynedd returns to Maeglin Gwynedd with the having cut off his lover's finger as proof, he is discovered to have been fooled, and therefore Maeglin is shamed by that. Now, Elphin, had he been able to keep his mouth shut about that, might have got out of prison, but he can't. Can't stop himself. So he exclaims how much this is not his wife. And he explains how how this finger couldn't possibly have belonged to his wife. And so reveals the illusion, in a sense, that Rin has been under, and therefore the disgrace and embarrassment of Gwaeglin. So then he's thrown into a deeper dungeon. Which means then that Taliesin in person has to go to the court of Maeglin and to disable the all of Maeglin's bards. Now, if you think for a moment of the bards, not just in their social kind of function, but as the beings that speak the world into being, that maintain the sovereignty of the king, therefore in his connection with the land, by their act of praising, by their act of recreation. When he sits in the corner of the room and makes the nonsense noise of blah, 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 he takes from them all the gift of speech. He takes from them all the power of the Arwen. And so the conversation that maintains the world in existence is stopped and taken from them all, and taken from Maeglin. And then what happens is he descends into all the halls of Maeglin, the deep dark halls of the imprisoner, of the tyrant, of the, be like going into Guantanamo Bay or somewhere like that. And because he has the speech of the making, and because he is at one with all things, all he can talk to each thing, and each thing opens to him. So all the doors open, all the locks open, the chains fall off Elphin, and he is brought out of prison. And this is the place where he makes his great vow that when anyone is either in prison, either of the body or the mind, he will come to them and set them free, because he can find the unity, the connection within all conditions. And in a way, the whole kind of point of the story, we get sort of need to finish in a couple of minutes for our lunch tea break, but we just read in just another bit of the of his self declaration, in a sense. So this is the song that's called The Reproof of the Bards. This is his this is Taliesin's telling off the bards, in a sense. If thou art a bard completely imbued with genius not to be controlled, be thou not untractable within the court of your king. Until your rigmarole shall be known, be silent, Heinen, as to the name of your verse and the name of your vaunting, and as to the name of your grandfather prior to his being baptized, and the name of the sphere and the name of the element and the name of your language and the name of your regent. Avant, ye bards above, avant, ye bards below. My beloved is below in the fetter of Ari Anrod. Now, so this is him saying, what he's saying is that the rigmarole of the bards is their own connection to the Awen, their own ancestral connection, their own understanding of the universe, the name of the sphere, the name of the element, the name of the language, the name of your region, their ability to kind of connect the, if you like, the infinite to the local. And then he says, my beloved, who is Elfin, is below in the fetter of Ari Anrod. Now, Ari Anrod, the great goddess of fate, whom we find in the fourth branch. And he's equating the chamber of the, he's equating the chamber or the prison chamber of Maeglin, and that Elfin is imprisoned in, with the fetter of Ari Anrod, where we find the great prisoner. So he's exploring one of the great deep traditions of Welsh tradition here. And he's saying, look, this is not just a small thing that's happening. My beloved is below in the fetter of Ari Anrod. It is certain you know not how to understand the song I utter, nor clearly how to discriminate between the truth and what is false. Puny bards, crows of the districts, why do you not take to flight? A bard that will not silence me, silence may he not obtain. So this is where we're the quality of the Tao. Silence may he not obtain until he goes to be covered under gravel and pebbles. Such as shall listen to me, may God listen to him. So if you're able to listen to Taliesin, if you're able to enter into that place of the Tao yourself, then God will listen to you. And he goes on. Minstrels persevere in their false custom. Immoral ditties are their delight. Vain and tasteless praise they recite. Falsehood at all times do they utter. Innocent persons they ridicule. Married women they destroy. Innocent virgins of Mary they corrupt as they pass their lives away in vanity. Poor innocent persons they ridicule. At night they get drunk, they sleep the day. In idleness, without work, they feed themselves. The church they hate, the tavern they frequent, with thieves and perjured fellows they associate. At courts they inquire after feasts. Every senseless word they bring forward, every deadly sin they praise, every vile course of life they lead. Through every village, town and country they stroll. Concerning the grip of death, they think not. Neither lodging nor charity do they give, indulging in victuals to excess. Psalms or prayers they do not use. Tithes or offerings to God they do not pay. On holidays or Sundays they do not worship. Vigils or festivals they do not heed. The birds do fly, the fish do swim. The bees collect honey, worms do crawl, everything travails to obtain its food, except minstrels and lazy, useless thieves. I deride neither song nor minstrelsy, for they are given by God to lighten thought, but him who abuses them, for blaspheming Jesus and his service. So you see there this kind of challenge to these useless bards who aren't fulfilling the true function of being a bard and are kind of singing praise songs to get fed and honour, as opposed to the true bard who is speaking the world into being. Okay, we'll have a break for half an hour because we're dealing with quite a lot really. And we'll see what you're making of all this. But in a way, if just to summarize there, the four branches gives us, if you like, this great mandala of the whole of Welsh tradition as understood by the bards, and there's lots of different layers in it. The story of Taliesin is really focusing on this idea of what is it to be a bard. And it really focusing on this territory of the Awen and the Tau, the Anian and the Ferum, and the particular sacred capacity that the bard has in this kind of process. Okay.
Ian.
Yes, Holly.
Can I quickly ask you? I'm finding it quite hard to follow everything, partly because I just keep losing connection, and I sort of feel like I need something to read. And later on, to sort of help bring it all together, would it be the Taliesin, the Book of Taliesin, or another, or something else?
Yeah, that's not as easy as it. I'll have to think about it, Ollie, because it's not as simple. There isn't a. There isn't a obvious one book that I can point at. It's just talking like I'm talking, because I'm talking like I'm talking, if you see what I mean.
But I looked up the in the lunch break, I looked up the ILO thing and I couldn't figure out this. I didn't.
Sorry, you looked up what, lovely?
The ILO, something, a book of, about ILO.
ILO. Oh, YOLO. You looked at YOLO. Okay. I'll have to think about it, Ollie, because there isn't. It'd be great if there was an obvious book I could just say, "Oh, let's have a look at that." But the thought of it is nothing. What I can think about in terms of what might be helpful.
Yeah, we might have to wait till you've written one.
Okay. Okay. Cool.
Thank you.
Okay, where are we now? So let's come back at 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock. Yeah. Have a nice cup of tea.
Thank you.
Okay.
Nanny. I'm painting a picture. Do you want to see?